And I think that new speedy brain surgery is covered in the GOP health care plan. That's Seth Meyers. I'm Cruiser. Welcome. It is Wednesday. We are live from our studios in downtown Lexington with another edition of Cruiser and Crew. Nice to have you with us this afternoon. Once again, the phone number, and you can call or text to this line, 253-5959, texting powered by Scheller Automotive, and the email address, cruiser@wvlkam.com. If you have been hearing throughout the day the sounds of bones cracking, that's emanating from our nation's capital, where arms are being twisted by the Trump administration, by the House Republican leadership, trying to get their members to go along and vote in the affirmative with a revised health care plan so that they can push this thing. This is like a hard delivery, trying to push this thing out of the House so it can go to the Senate. Today, GOP Representative Fred Upton, who, by the way, still to this day on this on his website. Now, Upton was a guy that was, you know, all through the 8 years of Obama, or ever since Obamacare was, we got to repeal and replace Obamacare. And it was still on his website as of last night. But then yesterday he said, well, I'm not going to support the new Republican plan. And I think the thing these guys, well, now he is, because he went up to the White House today along with Billy Long, and they got their arms twisted by Trump. And when they came out of the White House, you know, they were a little sore. You know, they were working the arms and the sockets and everything. And now they say they're going to support the Republican plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. Two key endorsements for legislation that's been teetering on the brink of collapse this week. And the House is about ready to go on recess next week. So they're trying to get this thing to a vote to get the votes that they need to approve this thing by the end of the week. And it seems that the sticking point is pre-existing conditions. But as I mentioned, I think it was yesterday, the idea, if you just casually peruse the media, is that, well, that's it. The states will be able to opt out of having coverage for people that's affordable if you've got a pre-existing condition. And that's not necessarily the case. So I wanted to get some clarification on this. So we have found the guy that literally co-wrote the book on pre-existing conditions last year. He co-wrote and edited a book on pre-existing conditions. He's a senior research fellow and healthcare scholar at the Mercedes Center at George Mason University. Dr. Robert Graybois joins us here on Cruiser and Crew this afternoon to talk about this. Dr. Graybois, welcome, sir.
Hey there. Thanks so much for having me.
So am I right here? Now, what I had come to understand about the pre-existing condition thing is that the Obamacare regulations on pre-existing conditions would still apply. So there would be no state where it would be possible for an insurance company to charge you more than a person without such a condition. The key is that you have not interrupted your coverage, that your coverage has remained in place. And under that scenario, and I guess even if your coverage didn't remain in place, they're going to set up these pools, you know, high-risk pools. Now, those have been shaky in the way they have worked or not worked in the past, but they would have a high-risk pool, which I think the Trump administration just threw another $8 billion into today to sweeten the pot. And we'll get to some of those numbers here in just a minute as to why the figure should be adequate for the high-risk pools. That's where you would go if you had a pre-existing condition. Am I right about all of that?
Well, it depends how they do it. I haven't seen the wording. I don't know that anyone has seen the wording on the Upton Amendment yet, but just lots of bits of information floating around. So the idea is if they do it according to something called invisible high-risk pools, yeah, you'd be, you know, if you're someone with an expensive condition that no insurer wants to cover because you're going to cost them more than you're going to bring in, you could sort of be tagged with this high-risk designation. You might never know it. And what would happen is when you went and bought your policy, the insurer would say, this guy's expensive. I will give up the premium he would be paying me in exchange for giving up a bunch of, you know, part or all of the risk of actually treating this guy for the conditions he's got. So what would happen is that the state would have a fund that would effectively pay for the care for the person. The insurer wouldn't get the premium, also wouldn't get the bills. Mm-hmm. And I, as a patient, might never know that I'm falling in that category. Now this could be a very expensive proposition. You know, people with pre-existing conditions, people with major illnesses, can be extraordinarily expensive. And my concern is that the $8 billion, even on top of some funding in there, is simply not going to be enough to do it.
Well, I got a column here from Betsy McCauley, who's at the London Center for Policy Research. Mm-hmm. Evidently, in the House bill, there was $130 billion of federal money to pay for people with pre-existing conditions. And I saw a report today where they've thrown in another $8 billion. Really, this pre-existing condition, even before Obamacare, there were 250,000 people a year with pre-existing conditions that were denied coverage for health reasons by major insurers. When the ACA came into effect back in 2010, it established a temporary program for people not being helped by the high-risk programs in states across the country, and about 115,000 people enrolled in that. Not a whole lot. Right. You add the two figures together, let's just highball it here to 400,000. If it's $32,000 a person, which is what the ACA's temporary program spent insuring people with pre-existing conditions, the federal fund would need $12.8 billion a year. So it would seem the $13 billion a year the GOP bill would provide over a decade or so would be adequate, although I know there's a lot of variables that could shake that up.
All right, so that big fund actually would cover a whole bunch of things. It would go into the high-risk pools, but also into other programs. So I don't know where exactly it would go, and I don't know that anyone else does. Mm-hmm. So what we're really talking here, specifically for the high-risk pools, is there's a $15 billion figure stretched over 9 years, and then they're adding another $8 billion, which would be stretched over 5 years. So you're talking about a couple of billion a year, and which, by my reckoning, back-of-the-envelope reckoning, is not nearly enough.
Mm-hmm.
High-risk pools, where they've been used in the past, have been notoriously underfunded.
Yeah.
I'm afraid it looks to me like that may be the case in this situation.
We would cover people with pre-existing conditions. I guess, Dr. Graybois, the question is just how do you do it? And
yep.
The discrepancy is, I mean, let's just make it real simple here. If I sell you a health insurance policy for 25 cents and your care is going to cost me $10 a month and you're only paying a quarter a month, that's
yep.
the rub, isn't it? You're not paying way enough in for the coverage that you're going to require.
Right. And the problem with the Affordable Care Act was that it said, well, you're supposed to keep, you know, when you're healthy, you're supposed to be paying in so that it'll, on average, cover sick people, except it had very weak strictures to keep you in. So lots of people said, I'm healthy. I'm not going to buy this. I just soon pay the penalty. So therefore, it was underfunded. Now, this is a bipartisan problem. Again, I think funding people with pre-existing conditions, and I think at this point there is very much a bipartisan consensus that it ought to be done in some way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that either party has reckoned with exactly how expensive this is. It's a very nice promise to make. It's heartwarming. Jimmy Kimmel did a big monologue on his newborn child who has a heart condition.
Yeah.
It's a great thing to promise. I mean, it sounds very heartwarming, but if you're not actually going to pony up enough dollars to actually do it, then that's kind of a problem. And I think that's where we are on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. There were funding problems with the current ACA as it exists now.
Sure.
So even if there's funding inadequacy, or again, this mantra that seems to be pushed is the pre-existing conditions codicil isn't going to be, states are going to be able to opt out of that totally, which I think that's a misrepresentation, but still on both sides. They haven't figured out how much it's going to be in the long run and how to fund it.
You know, the other day I was talking to another journalist who was asking me some of the mechanics of the high-risk pools. And after about half an hour, we got down to, okay, so basically the ACA says that healthy insurance subscribers ought to pay for the sick people. The high-risk pool idea is, no, actually taxpayers ought to. And the guy very astutely said, well, if the healthy person's premium drops, but now they've got to finance it out of their taxes, are they actually any better off?
Mm-hmm.
And I shrugged and said, well, you've asked exactly the right question. And it's, and the answer is who knows. some people, no doubt, would be better off. Some people would be worse off. And I don't know of any broad philosophical principle that would allow you to determine who's going to fall on which side of the line.
Yeah.
But, you know, the bottom line is this is a very expensive promise to make, and if you're going to make it, you have to, in my view, own up to the cost of what it is, and not just sort of hope that somehow the way you're doing it will make everything cheaper and better, or that money will somehow float in from somewhere you weren't expecting.
I don't think
we've reached that on either side of the aisle.
Well, no, we haven't. But isn't it hard when we don't know what the ultimate cost will be?
Yeah, absolutely. That is a problem.
Yeah.
It is, it's kind of like, it's analogous to what we faced with pensions, where we used to, most pensions used to be defined benefit, where it said, this is how much you're going to get for the next 30 years when you're retired.
Mm-hmm.
And we realized, well, that can be a problem if the investments don't go right, if the economy is going south. So most of us have moved to a defined contribution, which is here you're going to put this money in the account and hope, you know, you're going to manage it and work on it and see that it's what it ought to be when you get up there. But it depends on how everything goes, how the variables fall, and it's much less making a promise that you can't keep.
Well, there was a study of the Affordable Care Act that a couple of, I guess they're economists did this, one out of Harvard, two out of Harvard, actually, and one from the University of Texas in Austin. They did a study of the Affordable Care Act and concluded that insurers were already using benefit designs to screen out unprofitable consumers. So if you had an expensive condition, you know, I've long said this, doctor, the government is just as capable of denying you coverage or denying you some expensive medicine that you need, and just as much as a private insurance company would.
Oh, you bet they can. If you look at other countries that proclaim universal coverage, they finance it by not providing state-of-the-art drugs, by making you wait 7 years to get a surgery, or by not doing ample cleaning of hospitals, so they have high infection rates. Basically, you have to pay for stuff.
Yeah, and I guess some of this debate on pre-existing conditions, again, my understanding is the states wouldn't be able to mess with the regulations put in place by Obamacare if you had continuous coverage. I suppose the issue is somebody gets sick, doesn't have coverage, decides, need coverage now, and you can't charge me anymore now that I have this condition. And I'm shopping around for coverage. That's been one of the things that's been out of whack about the Affordable Care Act. That and the fact that you couldn't charge older consumers who are going to need more health care more than three times what you were charging somebody who was 28.
Right, right. And one of the amendments that's being put through on the Republican plan would say states are more than welcome to charge older folks more than five times as much. Now, my question is, you give the state that right, is the state actually going to do it and say, we would like to, poke a stick in the eye of AARP and all of the senior citizen voters? I have my doubts that anyone's going to take advantage of that.
Yeah. Are you generally a guy, doctor, that falls along the line that the states ought to be able to craft their own health care in that they ought to come up with their own regulations for the health care companies that do business in their states? Or, and I saw a poll today, I think it was Political Morning Consult, now, of course, and the poll goes along with sort of the mantra you've seen in the media for the last 48 hours that the GOP plan is going to take your pre-existing coverage away from you, pre-existing coverage, condition coverage away from you, and people don't want that. But there seemed to be this feeling that no, we need the federal government to design the guidelines of what health insurance companies should have to cover or not cover in various insurance plans. Which side would you fall on? Would it be more on the state should control it or the federal government should control that?
I'm on the side that says both the federal and the state governments, by and large, have done absolutely awful jobs of managing this stuff. sort of intuitively, I'm a federalist who likes to leave lots of decisions to the states. In the case of health insurance, pretty much across the board, not mm-hmm. every state, but most states, they've done really lousy jobs, and they're just as abusive as the federal government. What I am is a guy who says that the big problem is all we talk about is health insurance. That basically, you know, the difference between the GOP plans, the Democratic plans, and whatever, are the effects are small compared to other things that we ought to be focusing on. So no one is talking about the biggest item, which is the fact that the Medicare reimbursement system is, and I'm not exaggerating or being ideological, it is a Soviet-style price control system that misallocates resources and screws up the things all through the healthcare system, not just for Medicare people, that we're not focusing on the fact that we have state and federal laws and regulations that seriously inhibit competition and innovation in hospitals. The FDA slow walks drugs and devices that could be making care less expensive. The states do, again, some better than others, but mostly pretty awful jobs on professional licensure of physicians and others, scope of practice, certificate of need for hospitals so that you've got to beg the state if you want to add a CAT scan machine. These are the things that are really going to make a difference, as opposed to all the insurance issues, which is all we talk about in the healthcare debate, and that's mostly what we've talked about for 70 years.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem. The way we're going to fix things to improve healthcare, to get it to get to the point where we have better care for more people at lower cost year after year, kind of like the way we did with IT over the last 25 years, is we are going to have to find ways to take care that is provided by physicians and shift it to non-physicians like nurse practitioners, mm-hmm. To machines which are, you know, smart machines which are doing remarkable things in diagnostics and treatment. And to shift some of the burden to patients, and mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a guy who has some, a couple of medical devices that allow me to do things that 5 years ago only a doctor could have done, and
yeah.
They're very important. They're life-saving things.
So those things aren't that far off, though.
No,
and some of that's
here,
already here. Yeah,
they're here and they're coming fast, you know, really fast, and there are going to be lots of innovations, but again, anti-competitive hospitals, the Medicare reimbursement system, mm-hmm. the FDA approval system, and all these state regulations slow the whole thing down, so we don't get those things nearly as quickly as we could be. We could be doing a lot of good and sort of moving care downstream without compromising the quality at all. In fact, probably improving the quality.
And you think that would drive down the cost? There seems to be a basic difference between the two political strategies here. One wants to expand coverage, and the other one wants to bring down the cost.
I'm not going to put it that simplistically. My signature work is called Fortress and Frontier in American Healthcare. And I basically argue that the two parties are pursuing the same agendas in slightly different ways.
Hmm.
Both parties really pursue what I call the fortress strategy, which is public policy should serve two purposes. And one is to think of every terrible thing that could happen in healthcare and throw all your resources at trying to prevent all bad things from ever happening. And second is to protect people on the inside, be they doctors, hospitals, insurers, manufacturers, whatever. And both parties do that in their own distinctive ways, but they're both doing it. So, yes, one may talk more about coverage, although, again, both of them are saying people with pre-existing conditions need to be covered. Therefore, there's really not a lot of air between the two parties on coverage arguments at this point. And on cost, yeah, the people on the right might talk cost more,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know that they actually pursue it. They talk about things like buying and selling health insurance across state lines, which won't do anything.
Well, yeah, and what you say may be panning out here, Doctor, just in the way that some of these Republicans like Upton have been acting during this whole health care debate that we've seen play out over the last couple of weeks. They're not as strong in their position, nor are they standing behind the promises that they made over the last 7 or 8 years when push comes to shove.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's a promise problem again on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah,
I think both sides have.
Well, they want to stay in power. I mean, that also too. I think that may be a third thing.
This is a touchy issue, and the way both sides are pursuing it, there's not a lot of option to come out and be the big winner and be happy about it. You're going to have unfortunate conclusions because both sides are really playing a distribution game. They're not talking about really growing the capacity to provide health care or changing the way we deliver it. They're arguing over who gets first in line and who has to pay more than the other guy.
Yeah, it sounds like you think we ought to almost start from scratch.
Yeah, I think we ought to start on different issues. I've got something that's in the works. I haven't published it yet. It'll be out soon. Basically said, look, if passing this thing allows one side to say we have repealed and replaced Obamacare, while the other side says Obamacare is here to stay. You know, maybe we'll make some progress if they both sound like they're walking off the field victorious.
Yeah.
And then we can actually talk about these other things that are way more important than all of this insurance trivia that we've... I shouldn't say trivia. It's not trivial, but it is certainly not the big issues, and it's not what's going to be the salvation of the system in the long run.
Real quick, Doctor, before I let you go, I had a listener text me who was wondering if you could give an example of one of those medical machines.
Sure.
That you're using.
Got one in my pocket. So a year ago, I suffered a single bout of atrial fibrillation. So my heart went into arrhythmia, and I ended up in the ER, and they knocked me back into rhythm, and I was fine. I haven't had it since, but it's kind of a scary thing to have happen, and if you don't treat it right, you can have a massive stroke.
Right.
So anyway, about a week and a half later, they took me off my meds so I can take some tests, and I thought I was having it again. Went back to the ER, got all wired up, spent a few $1,000s, somebody did, so that I could be told, nah, nothing wrong, you're fine. Mm-hmm. And then about a month later, I thought I was having another problem on a desolate road in western Pennsylvania, but by then I had a device that's on my iPhone. And all I do is I touch my fingers on the back of the phone, and it does an electrocardiogram in 30 seconds, and it analyzes the wave pattern and tells me, am I having a problem or not? And before, if I hadn't had that, I probably would have headed to the nearest hospital, which was 20 miles away, and I probably would have gone in there, told them to wire me up. Someone would have spent thousands of dollars more to say, nah, you're okay.
You're okay.
Instead, my iPhone in 30 seconds said, nah, you're fine. Your heart rate's a little fast, but that's no big deal. But you are not having AFib. And as I drove away, I thought, well, I just saved. I didn't have to spend the night here. I didn't have to wire up. And U.S. healthcare spending will be probably $3,000 to $5,000 less in 2016, because I bought this inexpensive little device that goes on my iPhone.
And where'd you get it? Off the internet?
Well, it comes from a company called AliveCor. It is a clinical quality EKG, and it's FDA approved, and it was invented by a doctor in Oklahoma City by the name of Dave Albert. His father used to be Speaker of the House of the United States.
Right, I remember that. Carl Albert.
Yep, Carl Albert. Yep, yeah. His son is a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And invented this device, and it's $99. And frankly, anyone who has heart arrhythmia, I can't imagine why they wouldn't have this thing, because the peace of mind it brings, and the, you know, keeping you out of ER when you're not having a problem, or if you are having a problem, it tells you, you know, you better get yourself over and get checked in because you're having a problem.
Yeah.
So this is one device. I could sit here and rattle off all day other devices like that, and there are others in the works. In 10 years from now, we will have just piles of these things. There was a device that was a multi-million-dollar prize was just given called the Qualcomm Tricorder X Prize for a device under 5 pounds that does clinical quality diagnosis of 13 different illnesses and conditions, including heart arrhythmia, in various infections, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a little tiny device, not much bigger than a cell phone, and it can do all these diagnoses. And the inventors just got a few million dollars. And, you know, my guess is 5-10 years from now, every household is going to have devices like this, and probably way farther along than that one.
Fascinating stuff. Robert Grabois, Senior Research Fellow and Healthcare Scholar at the Mercatus Center and at George Mason University. Dr. Grabois, thank you so much for the time. It was very interesting, and please come back and join us again.
You just ask, and I'll be back.
Thank you, sir. That was great. Interesting stuff. He's got a point. Are we even debating the right things in this whole healthcare argument at all? We'll shift gears and talk about tax reform in the state of Kentucky with one of the co-founders of a conservative think tank run by millennials in the state of Kentucky, the first one of its kind in the nation. The Pegasus Institute is what it is called, and we'll talk with a gentleman by the name of, Jordan Harris. I had it right, but I thought I'd better check. Jordan Harris will join us next. We'll talk tax reform in the state of Kentucky when we continue here on a busy edition of Cruiser and Crew, News Talk 590 WVLK.
I'm Alan Edwards. It's 3:33. Here are the stories you'll be talking about on News Talk 590 WVLK. After a tumultuous history, a famous-for-sales landmark is finally off the market. Castle Post has apparently been sold. The $15 million home is listed as sale pending. The famed home was left abandoned and uncompleted for nearly 30 years. In 2004, the castle caught on fire and was rebuilt. The Federal Reserve is leaving interest rates where they are for now. Correspondent Jan Johnson reports.
The Fed is pausing after modest raises to the benchmark short-term rate in December and March. The report following its latest policy meeting also signals confidence in a resilient U.S. economy and solid job market, which could justify further rate hikes later this year. The statement from the Fed notes that the economy slowed during the January-March quarter, but says it expects that slowdown to be transitory. Jan Johnson, Washington.
And I'm Alan Edwards on News Talk 590 WVLK, where Lexington comes to talk.
We've got highs in the mid-60s and partly sunny skies Wednesday. A beautiful day compared to what's coming later this week. Low 50s, few showers late tonight. Thursday, showers, even occasional thunderstorms possible. With highs in the upper 60s, a wet Thursday. Unfortunately, the showers will linger Friday. More showers and we're cooling off. Friday's highs, only in the mid-50s. That's the LAX 18 Storm Tracker 3-day forecast. I'm meteorologist Tom Ackerman on your official weather station, News Talk 590, WVLK.
And right now we have 65 degrees at your official weather station, News Talk 590, WVLK.